call the Judiciary Committee to order. It's about 1:34. We have two things that we're going to bring before us today. We have some testimony on House Bill 284, which is a compact for a balanced budget. Some more discussion questions. We have, I think, Chip DeMoss online. And then we're going to get to House Bill 369, which is Majority Leader Pruitt on drug overdose immunity from prosecution. And we'll take that up as soon as we can. So I think we have the sponsor's representative here for so you heard some of the questions the last time. Is there anything that you wanted to add before we go to public testimony? Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
For the record, Ernest Prox, staff to Representative Keller. I know, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't here actually at the last meeting. I was working on your bill. from my understanding, there were some questions, I think, that came up, and I believe Chip DeMoss from the Compact for America is online, and Nick Geranius from the Goldwater Institute, he might be on his line as well. So right. Most of the questions, I think, will defer to him. And if there's something I can help out with, I'll try to do that.
All right. Well, we'll get Chip DeMoss up first for testimony, and then we'll answer a few questions at this point. So thank you. Chip, can you hear us all right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, hear you loud and clear.
So last time we met, there was a handful of questions. Were you listening in on that last go-around?
Yes, there was a request that we send the detailed information from the McLaughlin polling information, which we did pass along that same day back to right. You and the members of the committee, and we also sent an economic study that was performed by two leading economists that are on the Compact for America Advisory Council that I think got to the crux of the matter of prioritization of expenditures at the federal level.
Okay.
So we did not get any questions over the past couple of days for follow-up, so I just wanted to make myself available online in case there were any questions from the committee today.
Well, there'll be a couple questions that I have to make sure that we get them online on record. The compact, at this point, it looks to me like the governor gets to be the lead from each state, and the states are bound to this contractually unless 3/4, I think, is reached. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's when the dominoes all fall, is when the 38th state joins, and it's anticipated that at that point in time, Congress will already have approved the congressional resolution. So the convention itself would be scheduled for approximately 45 days after the 38 states join. So the convention, in being limited to 24 hours, everything would be over and done with in less than 2 months after that point in time.
And the way I understand it is the convention is really revolving around just the balanced budget. So would it be just making the language of the balanced budget to send back to Congress? Is that how that works?
No, the language is all, when you join the compact, the states are saying not only do they want to propose the amendment, they also are providing ratification of the amendment as well in the compact. In a later section in the compact is the actual pre-ratification of the amendment.
Well, that's what I understand.
In the congressional resolution that Congress is anticipated will pass at some point in the near future, they will agree to send the balanced budget amendment, if it's proposed by the convention, back to the state legislatures for ratification. That will be in the congressional resolution. And because the state legislature has already provided the pre-ratification in the compact, there's no need for any further legislative activity on the part of any member state.
And what's the anticipation of 45 days then, Chip?
45 days is the time it would take just to be able to coordinate the logistics for conducting the convention. It's scheduled, if Congress calls it as anticipated by the compact, it'll be held in Dallas, Texas. And so it was felt that we needed to set a convention date. We don't know what the exact date would be, but we set it at 45 days after the 38 states joined, assuming that Congress will already have agreed to call the convention in accordance with the compact.
Senator Dyson has a question for you, Chip.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I want to be clear that I understood what you just said. Did I understand you to say that if the state was in the resolution that they passed now, after the convention meets, it would not be necessary for each individual state to ratify after the convention?
That's correct. Let me point you to the exact section in the compact so you can look at it.
No, I'll take your word for it. So if that's true, then that implies that every state's call for a convention has to be virtually identical in defining the issue and the issues to be describing the issue and the issues to be worked on in the convention has to be identical language?
That's correct. And the actual call is contained in the compact, so when a member state joins, that language will be identical among all 38 member states for the application to the convention, which is basically applying to Congress to call a convention in accordance with the terms and provisions of the compact to only deal with the specific balanced budget amendment that's contained in the compact itself.
Thank you.
That's in Article 5. That's on page 9. That's Article 5. It goes from lines 9 to 18 is the actual application. And then in Article 9 on page 14, on lines 17 to 25, is the actual resolution prospectively ratifying the balanced budget amendment if it is passed at the convention and if it is referred to the state legislatures for ratification by Congress.
Thank you.
I think I also have Nick Dranius online. He's with the Goldwater Institute. He's available for questions. So maybe either Chip or Nick, welcome to the committee, Nick. The application for the convention is going to come out of this compact to Congress, and then Congress then is to refer the balanced budget amendment to the individual states for ratification. That's the way I understand it, true?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Nick Dranius, Director of Policy Development, Constitutional Government, Goldwater Institute. It's my pleasure to answer the question. In essence, yes. The design of the compact is for there to be a congressional resolution that would be a counterpart to the compact, and the congressional resolution is actually drafted and available online. As currently drafted, it would be an omnibus resolution with two main parts. The first would be the call of the convention, and the second would be the selection of legislative ratification. And the goal would be to pass that singular resolution at one time and thereby lock in Congress's commitment to the selection of legislative ratification in advance before it might get cold feet.
All right. That helps me. Is there any other questions at this point? I just wanted to make sure that the committee notices and welcomes Senator McGuire to the committee. Senator McGuire, what we're doing is we're taking a look at House Bill 284, which is relating to the Interstate Compact for a Balanced Federal Budget. And we're just kind of going through some of the questions on how does that work. Mm-hmm. And I know that, and Nick, this is probably for you, this is a binding contract the way I read it, but the binding part happens once you get the number of states to make it a in effect compact, which I think is 39, is that correct? 35?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the entrenchment or the binding quality of the compact where you cannot withdraw until it's performed or sunsetted only occurs when 38 states join the compact, and that is to coincide with the effective date of the application for the convention. And it's really intended to ensure that none of the member states back out of the laser focus of the process before the convention has an opportunity to meet and either vote up or down the proposed amendment.
Okay. And the cost for each delegate is to be borne by each state individually?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the answer would be yes, but it's important to emphasize that it is completely optional as to whether the state funds the compact commission as it's currently drafted, and the only costs that are being contemplated for delegates are the reimbursement of travel expenses.
Okay, gotcha. Any questions? Anything you ever wanted to know about the compact? Now is your turn. Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Does this, I alluded to this in the last meeting, but I'm a little unclear. Does this apply during the time of war?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lukowski, the answer is yes. And the amendment contained allows for flexibility in the debt limit. It allows for two forms of flexibility. First, the debt limit itself can be thought of as a gigantic revolving line of credit, which, if it were, say, ratified in the near future, could be as much as $21 trillion. And so if we ever got back to the old Gingrich Clinton days and actually started generating surpluses again, it'd be very prudent for the federal government, and would certainly have the option of paying down the debt and freeing up some of that revolving line of credit for use in emergency situations. In addition to that degree of flexibility, again, a $21 trillion revolving line of credit, there's also the ability to lift the debt limit, but the power over lifting the debt limit is not left in the sole hands of Congress. And it is, you know, it's something that requires a majority of state legislatures to approve. Now, the reason why we do not allow for Congress unilaterally to determine when the limit should be lifted, whether for a war or anything else, is that we would find ourselves, we believe, in a situation where wars might never end. And in fact, if you look at history, generally, in fact, in every legitimate war that we would all agree was a legitimate war, there's never been a problem marshaling 70%+ of the American people behind it, and 26 states would certainly not be a problem at all. And the other point I'd like to emphasize, and I think Representative Keller hit this nicely in his opening testimony, is that, you know, there's always cash flow coming into the federal government every minute of every day. At least, you know, we're only borrowing 40 to 45% of every dollar we're spending. So that means, you know, 60 to 55% of every dollar we're spending is actually in cash flow. And if you look at the division of the federal government's budget and you segregate out the discretionary and non-discretionary spending, and you actually look at how much is being spent on the military as a percentage of the overall budget, it's actually under 20%. And so, you know, logistically, there's enough cash flow, more than enough, twice, maybe three times as much as we currently spend on the military coming in from taxes. And so if there were any, you know, severe, significant military spending needs, without skipping a beat, you know, the federal government could double, even maybe triple, its current military expenditures without having to borrow anything.
Senator Wilkowski.
Partially comment, but partially a question, I guess. How is this a balanced, how is this seeking a federal balanced budget when we're still allowing $21 trillion worth of debt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it turns out the only way to have a non-gamable day-to-day restriction of spending to taxes is to allow for some degree of borrowing. As ironic as it sounds, think of it this way. If you don't allow for some borrowing to bridge the gap between spending and taxes, whenever you have volatility in taxes, which we always have, then you simply would have to stop spending. And there's some spending prerogatives that just can't stop whenever the tax flow gets volatile. So in order to make a definition of limiting spending to taxes work in a way that cannot be gamed with playing around with budgets, making it entirely cash flow based, the only way that can work is if you do allow for some degree of borrowing flexibility to handle cash flow volatility. And that's a discovery that I think states made early in the 20th century. If you look at, for example, Arizona's constitution, if you look at some of like New Mexico's, or I wouldn't be surprised, you have to forgive me, I wouldn't be surprised also if some aspects of this would be in Alaska's constitution. What you find is most constitutions that have a balanced budget requirement also provide for a limited amount of debt capacity. And the concept at the time was to ensure that their pay-as-you-go model allowed for an ability to deal with cash flow volatility from taxes. The problem is they didn't specifically define their balance in terms of having no more than the amount of money you got in the bank to spend every day. Instead, they still tied the definition of balance to budgets. And as you know, as we know, budgets can be wrongly estimated, and dare we say, even gamed. So in the end, that's why many state balanced budget or debt limit requirements fail to do a perfect job. They do a better job than not having anything, but they often fail to do a perfect job or a good job of restraining debt because in the end they define their balance in terms of budget projections, which are at best inaccurate and at worst gamed. And so bottom line, coming back to your question, there's simply in our research over a couple of years, and then going past that, going to my research and other research in the state constitutional matters, the sad fact is there is no way to prevent all of the known ways in which balanced budget amendments are gamed in the states, which we can assume would happen at the federal level, except to define balance strictly in terms of cash flow at every point in time. And unfortunately, there's no way to do that without having some flexibility allowing for you to tap a revolving line of credit of some kind to deal with cash flow volatility. And then in the end, the question is how big should that revolving line of credit be? If we hadn't already racked up so much debt, it would be probably more reasonable to put that number closer to $1 trillion, maybe $2 trillion. But we have racked up all that debt, and we don't want to undercut it. The good news is that over time, the economic impact of that borrowing capacity will shrink relative to the overall economy. So in a sense, as time goes on, as our economy grows, having a fixed debt limit eventually will, over dozens of years, will eventually become insignificant.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you probably know, Alaska receives the most amount of money per capita from the federal government of any state in the country. If we pass this amendment, do you foresee that that number, which is over $15,000 per Alaskan, would decrease?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's difficult to project what would happen with this amendment in place in terms of state recipients of federal funds. And the reason why it's difficult to project is that there's two different things in play. First, states, remember, control the debt limit now. So one would think that Congress would be much nicer to the states than they've ever been. And so one would think that if Congress decided to make a proposal of lifting the debt limit, they probably would not, as their tactical move, gut unreasonably the funding of any particular state, particularly since in order to get approval for any increase in the debt limit, they would have to originate a measure from both houses of Congress in which even smaller states like Alaska and the Senate have a fairly significant voice. So, my first point would be the states are empowered by this amendment to have more influence over national debt policy and, indeed, by implication, more influence over national policy than they currently have. At the same time, however, it's harder, admittedly and by design, for the federal government to get debt. And so to the extent that the federal government's spending is dependent on debt, then it means that more likely than not, the federal government will spend less. Now, who will take the biggest hit? Will it be a state like Alaska? Again, there are a lot of other interest groups that might see their spending cut long before any spending to the states is hurt, again, because the states now have a role in national policy in approving any increase in the federal debt limit. So I would think that a rational Congress would put the interests of the states ahead of, you know, just your ordinary spending interests in light of that dynamic. But in the end, you know, none of us, any state, any person, anyone who hopes to receive any sort of federal benefit, none of us are going to be in a better position if the government spends us over the fiscal cliff. Because when the government does that and everything's defaulted, there will not be any borrowing. There will only be printing of money and inflation. And in the end, if we want to preserve what federal spending is necessary, the first thing we need to do is to start treating debt like a limited resource.
Senator Wolkowski, to continue.
On the idea of the selection of having the governors of each particular state be the delegate, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be better to have someone else, governors who would vote to have federal funds slashed to their own states would probably receive a fair degree of backlash within their states. So I'm wondering if maybe it wouldn't be a better idea to have someone maybe appointed by the governor, appointed by the legislature, to be the delegate.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the default setting is the governor. There are good policy reasons for that default setting. It's not set in stone. If there were, there are a number of elements of the compact that can be tailored to each individual member state without threatening the formation of the compact, and the selection of delegates is one of those things that can be modified. It is possible to change the default selection from the governor to up to three delegates of any identity that the legislature decides that it would like to have as its delegates as an alternative. Now, that being said, I would urge, and I think that the better policy still is to have the governor be the sole delegate, and the reason is twofold. One, the policy making that's involved in this process is ongoing right now, in essence. I mean, the function of the convention is really to give people an opportunity to make sure, you know, take a look, good long, hard look before they leave and make sure that this really is the right, you know, amendment that the Constitution should have after we've gone through 38 states in deliberation. But the deliberation, the substance of the deliberation, mostly is occurring right now with the debate over this bill. And so really the kind of delegate that you want to go to the convention is one who will see his job as primarily protecting the process, not so much engaging in, you know, the deliberation, although it's important, but relatively speaking, just making sure the process stays honest. And I think the fewer variables you have in doing that, the fewer political actors you have engaged in that, the more certainty you can bring to the process. And I would urge that also because one of the things that we found is that for those who are afraid of the convention process, not knowing who's going to the convention and not knowing the political dynamics that might play out, whatever the law may say, is very troubling to them. And ultimately, if we're going to get to 38 states, we need to pull a large number of those skeptics into the fold. So for their comfort's sake and given the nature of the convention, I would still stand by the default selection as the best selection without, you know, having any particular knowledge of a particular governor. But then again, the flexibility is there should this legislature disagree.
Senator Wolkowski, to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill requires only half the states, a simple majority of the states, to increase the national debt limit. many
Mr.
states.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if anyone can hear me, but I cannot hear anyone.
Okay. How's that? Is that a little better? Can you hear me?
Did we get cut off? We may have run into some technical difficulties. Nick, can you hear us? Chip, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear now.
All right.
Okay. So as I understand the bill, it requires only a simple majority of the states to increase the national debt. Given that you have many states with budget problems, it seems to me like you could pretty easily get a majority of the states to increase the national debt. If the real goal is to drive down the national debt, shouldn't we increase that number to, say, two-thirds?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I personally would love to see the number at 9/10 of the states. The problem is that if you look at the political dynamics of the country, and I think we even hear it here in a microcosm, if you make the flexibility over increasing the debt too difficult, you politically box yourself out of getting the job done. And so, really, I would ask you to consider the amendment this way. If your target is 38 states, including some incredibly blue and purple states, places potentially like Illinois, if your target is persuading those states, what is the best plausible debt restraint that we could obtain? And I would suggest to you that while this is not perfect, it certainly is a vast improvement over the status quo, if only for the difficulty that we're adding to the process of raising the debt limit. Because Congress obviously can raise and suspend the debt limit quite easily on a moment's notice anytime it wants, as it has. But the prospect of having to get 26 states to approve it within 60 days, in addition to passing a measure out of each House of Congress that would go out to the states for their referendum, the logistics in that cannot help but ensure a better and more transparent debate. And if the polling is right and 70 to 80% of the American people really do want to restrain the debt, their voices will be heard in your state capitals, even if it's only 26 of them, far, far more effectively, not all the time, but far more effectively than in Washington. So on the whole, we're going to bend the curve away from mindless debt increases, but at the same time, by keeping it more flexible than a hard right guy like me might prefer, we're going to also enable the ability to bring on board some of the purpley states that we need.
One more question for you, Senator Wilkowski, and then I'll go to Dyson, and then back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read it, this bill gives the president sweeping authority to make over the budget-making process. It gives the president the right to designate any spending request. Is tantamount to giving him the power to rewrite laws passed by Congress. Isn't this rewriting Articles 1 and 2 of the Constitution, which explicitly placed all legislative power in Congress?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, respectfully, no. What you're referring to is the impoundment regulation that's included in the amendment. Under current case law right now, the president has impoundment power. Because what impoundment power is the executive ability to decide when bills are paid when there aren't enough funds to pay them. And so whenever you have any sort of business or governmental body that has cash flow coming in at some time, bills coming in at another, it's implicit in any executive's power to have the ability to impound, that is, delay or reprioritize spending to match cash to bills. And so the question, and in fact, if you think about all the debt limit debates we've had over the few years, inevitably the president pulls that card out of his back pocket at the last minute and threatens to impound all sorts of important and popular benefit programs, and then all of a sudden everybody caves and the debt limit is suspended or increased. So the reality is right now, under the status quo, the president has impoundment power. It has to have impoundment power. And the president tends, you know, on the right or the left, and the Republican Party or the Democrat Party, tends to use that power fairly aggressively, some might even say abusively. And so given that reality, the amendment regulates the impoundment power. It says the president must impound spending once the spending gets within 98% of the debt limit. And what that means, given current borrowing rates, is that basically 3 to 6 months before hitting any debt limit, the president would have to start designating what he intends to delay or reprioritize when the debt limit is reached. And so instead of having this panicky midnight hour debate and threats and abuse that we often see, you would have a transparent laying of cards on the table as to exactly what's at stake if the debt limit is to be enforced. The president would lay out his cards. He would say, here is what I intend to impound. And then the Congress, unlike currently, keep in mind, right now, when the president threatens to impound something, the only thing Congress can do in response is to try to repeal the appropriation, which requires the president's signature, which is not much of a check or balance at all. But under this amendment, as soon as the president lays out his impoundments, the Congress has the ability within 30 days by concurrent resolution, meaning without presentment, to override those impoundments with equal or greater amounts. So in fact, what we've done here is we've forced the president to use his impoundment power responsibly, with enough time for a real debate about it, and we've enhanced the power of Congress to check and balance any abuse in that process. And at the same time, structurally, we've prevented the game of chicken that happens at the last few minutes before the debt limit every time that Congress has debated it in the past.
Senator Dyson, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. I have two. Virtually all states only meet for a few months each year. In some states, I think the legislature meets every other year. So that would seem to me to mitigate against the states meeting, agreeing, and acting with dispatch to accomplish what you're talking about. I'd like your comments on that, and I have one other question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee, that's a great observation. One can assume two things about the states if this amendment were to be adopted, that they would maintain the current status quo or that they would adjust their current laws and policies regarding sessions of their legislature to allow for the states to exercise their newfound power. Granted, I'm only 43 years old. Granted, I've only been practicing law for 16 years and focused in constitutional law for 8, and only been in maybe 20 or 30 state legislatures in giving testimony. But I strongly suspect, based on that small amount of experience, that states generally will like to exert and exercise what new powers they get, and that if their current laws or constitutions would prevent them from regularly or easily exerting their new power over the federal debt limit, that they would more likely than not amend those laws and policies and make it fairly easy for them to exercise their new power. My response would be that I don't know if this is a good thing. This could be a bug as much as a feature, but I expect that states, being enamored of power generally, like any governmental body tends to be, that states will adjust their legislative session laws as needed to ensure that they can participate in the national debate over any debt limit.
Okay, I got
but
it.
But if they don't, I just want to emphasize, I'm not so sure that's necessarily the ideal policy from a center-right perspective. I would almost rather have fewer states in session so that we could see more debt limits refused. But nevertheless, in the end, it's up to the states. It depends how important it is to them to participate in the process.
Okay, thank you. You gave me a lot more answer than I wanted, and I heard it the first time you said it, and I say that respectfully. The second question, I've been paying a bit of attention to this movement for quite a while, and it appears to me there's 3 or 4 national organizations trying to work with legislators for an Article 5 convention, and maybe 1 or 2 working against it. And it's the sense of my colleagues here that we're trying to do 2 things: to satisfy each one of the groups that are working on its language and get something going, and then add our state's name to the queue of states calling for an Article 5 convention. And I assume when we get to or get close to the number of states that we will all quickly try to work to readjust our exact and precise wordings to get the consistency that's required. Would you comment on that, sir?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee, I think that is a valid observation as to what could happen. I would emphasize that because the compact does not become entrenched until 38 states join it, there's obviously plenty of opportunity for adjustment along the way. I don't know, you know, sight unseen, if it would be good adjustments, but the possibility exists. And I'm sure, as the chairman can attest, it is fairly routine that existing compacts are amended along the way among the many, many, many compacts that exist. They're tweaked all the time.
Thank you. Thanks for helping us. Well, just one more, if I may follow up. Would you comment on the several groups that seem to be working with us on variations of this issue and how we should view that?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee, there are three major groups on the center-right and then at least one major group on the center-left. The three major groups on the center-right would be, of course, Compact for America, Convention of the States, and the BBA Task Force. And then on the center-left, it's Professor Lawrence Lessig's group. I think it's called Amend Now or States for Amendments. The basic commonality that exists is that I think we all kind of cross-pollinate on the importance of not being fearful of using the Article 5 amendment power. We all have different policy focuses, we all have different approaches, but by and large, on the left and the right, we're committed to dissolving fear of the process.
Thank you.
I could keep on talking if you like.
Yeah. No, and I appreciate that the senator actually has to go to another committee where he has a bill being heard, so he's left us. We do have Senator Wilkowski, and Senator, just for what it's worth, I was going to set this aside at 2:20 about and take up the representative's bill.
This will be my last question, Mr. Chair. just on it doesn't appear to me that there's a sunset clause. And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But on page 7 of the bill, it says the commission and the compact's administrator's activities shall be funded exclusively by each member state as determined by the respective state law or by voluntary donations. So I'm a little concerned that we have a commission that we're creating with no sunset clause. It could go on indefinitely. And we as a state will be funding it with very little oversight, not knowing where the money will go to. I assume there's going to be agencies, lobbyists hired. Am I wrong about any of this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee, you are wrong about it. If you go to the very last provision of the compact, you'll see the termination clause. The termination clause states that 7 years from the first enactment by the first state, the compact is self-repealed. In regards to the funding of the compact, the funding provision is one of those provisions that can be modified state to state. It's not intended, as currently written, to mandate any funding. It's intended to make funding entirely dependent on state law, as it states that it's subject to state law. So currently there is no funding obligation in the language. Now, in terms of what could be used or what could be done if there were funding of the commission's powers are set out specifically in the first portion of that article. And it does include lobbying, so it really would be dependent on what the commission chose to do. The commission, of course, is populated by the first three states that enact the compact. It can be expanded later, but the first three states that enact the compact control the commission, and the majority vote of those states' representatives will decide how the commission behaves.
All right, well, that gets us into some of the detail of the commission. Tell you what I'm going to do. We're right at a place where I have another bill that I wanted to bring up for a House member. So both Chip and Nick appreciate what we'll do is we're going to set aside this bill, and we will probably bring it up for some discussion, debate, and hopefully a vote on Monday. That'll be the 7th. And so at this point, we'll lay House Bill 284 aside. And thank you very much for being with us. I think you got us in really deep into the topic. Next, we will go to House Bill, let's see, we're 369. I'm sorry, I kept saying 366. I even told Senator McGuire the wrong bill earlier. Why don't you come on forward? We have a representative from Majority Leader Pruitt's office. This deals with the reporting. Restrictions on criminal prosecution. That's what it is.
Do you want a motion, Mr. Chairman, on the CS?
Not yet. I want to let them introduce it, and I'll explain at this point about the CS. First thing I wanted to do is have 369 brought before us. And now we have Representative Pruitt's office here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Morgan Hobson, staff to Representative Lance Pruitt. I do believe that the representative is online, too. And I might actually defer to him to introduce it before I go into more detail.
Representative, welcome to our committee. You're online. You want to go ahead and introduce the bill, Representative?
Can I say something?
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Before you get started, Senator McGuire wanted to make a comment.
Thank you. Before we get started, through the chair, I just want to say congratulations to you, Lance, on your Top 40 Under 40 award today.
I appreciate that.
Will not influence any votes on it.
All right.
You have the floor.
All right. Well, thank you. For the record, Representative Lance Pruitt represents the District 25, which is East Anchorage, and Senator McGuire indicated, that is why I'm not there present with you today. I just left not too long ago the lunch for the Top 40 recipients, and it's a great honor. A lot of great great individuals that they recognize. Before you have HB 369. HB 369 is a measure that is intended to essentially save lives. This idea came to me really from kind of reading some of the best practices from other states, either through various news articles or even some of the magazines that we received, such as Governing. And I saw this measure that in 14 other states that had approved. And it really tackled something that has been a challenge, especially in an area like East Anchorage, where we have seen the growth of drug use increase, and I believe you have in your backup information that paperwork that would indicate that it's not just in East Anchorage, but in Alaska overall, there's been an increase in actually deaths, to tell you the truth, from drug use. And what we are intending to do with this legislation is we are intending to ensure that an individual who is may have made a poor decision and overdosed, that the individuals that are with them, say friends or whoever else that may potentially be participating in the same action, would have a certain restriction from prosecution for that individual who did not overdose if they took the opportunity to call in or to stop, drop the person at the hospital, whatever it may be, to assist getting help for that person. They have to make a good faith effort to try to save that person's life. But the restriction from prosecution only rests in the personal possession that they have. We have ensured that it does not apply in general. It is not a broad immunity. They do not gain an immunity from, say, some other illicit activity that they may have done, say, maybe selling the drugs, or in certain cases, certain other actions that might have put that person or others in some sort of an endangered scenario. But in this case, if they make that good faith effort, that personal amount that they have on them,
there would be a restriction from prosecuting. The goal here is that, as I mentioned earlier, let's say you have two individuals. Actually, I'll use an example from Shubiak High School several years ago. A young man overdosed. From my understanding, he overdosed and actually fell and hit his head. And his friends were worried about getting in trouble. And so that young man was placed, from my understanding, in the back of a pickup truck. And he ended up actually passing away in the back of that pickup truck because his friends were worried about the trouble that they may get into. Our goal here is to save that young person's life, first and foremost, and to really put in place, as we have found in from other states, namely Washington, where they put this in place in 2010, where many times the police officers responding were not actually that individual. They may not actually put that person into a scenario where they have to go to court or they may go to prison. The research that you should have from Washington indicates that a large portion of the time they use their the deference that is allowed to them to not necessarily press charges against that individual. But those individuals don't necessarily know that that's going to be the case. And, of course, there's a fear that that may not be the case. So that's why they may feel that they may not want to make that phone call. What we do here is we're basically putting street law into actual law. So what many times happens on the street, we're going to put out there so that individuals will know they can make that call and they will not need to worry about their mistake in the possession that they have. If there's something beyond that, they'll still have to answer for that. But that the possession that they have, they will be able to save their friend's life and not have to worry about that aspect of the consequence. With that, I will pass it on to Morgan. If there's a desire from the committee for the specifics and the details in the bill, but I appreciate you hearing this, and again, apologize that I could not be there, but thank you so much for taking the time to hear this, what I think will be a life-saving bill.
Thanks, Lance. Appreciate you taking the time to introduce it to us. Now it looks like Morgan gets to answer all the questions. So, but we do have Kathleen Strasbaugh online, who's from Ledge Legal, and I have Randy Hahn, Wasilla, who's in Wasilla from the Alaska State Troopers. So, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might briefly describe the changes that have been made in the bill on the House side in committee. The first change that we made was to replace the term immunity with the term a restriction from prosecution. And the reason we did this is because we came to understand that immunity in Alaska state law may imply transactional immunity, which could potentially make it more difficult to prosecute other offenses that may have occurred in the circumstance that led the officer to interact with the individual who made that life-saving call. And so we changed it to restriction from prosecution, or changed it to restriction from prosecution, and this narrowly does apply just to certain possession offenses that are outlined in the bill. So it would not relieve someone from charges of reckless endangerment or assault, intent to distribute or manufacture, and so on. And the second change that we made, we will see in a blank CS that we have brought, and I can speak to that later.
All right. Can you walk us through the codes that you have here under Section 1? And I think they're repeated again in the A and Sub 2. Just give us the... 1171-030A3. Do you have a list of which codes those are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They are all possession offenses. And for the details, without having the statute in front of me, I may defer to Kathleen Strasbaugh to answer that in better detail.
All right. Well, maybe I'll just do that, just so that we have that on the record. Kathleen, can you hear us?
Mr. Chairman, did you wish me to speak?
Yes, if you wouldn't mind, just give us the what each one of these statutes on line 7, page 1 are, and it looks to me like they're repeated again. on page 2, line 8.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services. The statutes are as follows. 1171-030A3 involves is misconduct involving controlled substance in the third degree. That part of that statute that regards possession of any amount of Schedule 1A or 2A controlled substance, basically near a school grounds, youth center, or on a school bus. And then 4, and that's the next one is 1171-040A3 and 4.
Okay.
That's misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree. 3 governs possession of any amount of a controlled substance, Schedule 1A. A 2A controlled substance listed in the schedule, and I think that's the bath salt. And then 25 or more tablets, ampules or syrettes containing 3A or 4A, and then a small list of particular amounts of various Schedule 3A, 2A, 3A, and 4A substances. And so there's a bit of a list there. And then 4 is possession of 3A, 4A, 5A, or 6A, which is the lower risk controlled substances, also within near a school grounds, youth center, or on a school bus. 1171-050A2, misconduct involving controlled substances in the fifth degree, also is a possession offense affecting smaller amounts of the substance, most of the substances in misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree. And then 1171-060A1 or 2, involves use or display of, only the possession part of this one. Sub 2 is smaller amounts of 6A, which is marijuana, and 3A, which is a set of other substances that have been sprayed on tobacco, an herb, or organic material. And then and also use or display of any marijuana product. So those are the various offenses that a person may not be prosecuted for under this particular provision and the one that follows.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry to take up all your time in looking at those, but Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, I don't know if this is if they're the person to answer this question, and I'd be curious if there's any statistics on how many people this potentially would have applied to in the last few years.
I think there was a research paper done. Was there any statistics on the application within the last few years in Alaska? To the sponsor's representative.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I would like to make sure that I understand the question correctly. Does this pertain to persons calling in for someone who's had an overdose?
I'm just wondering, had this law been in place for, say, the last 5 years, how many people would it have, if you know, I don't know if they keep those statistics, that would have applied to?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't have exact statistics on that, but I may be able to provide some information that would help us understand what that impact may have been. In the last 5 years or so, the Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics reports the annual fatalities from drug overdoses to range between 100 and 130 or so a year. And to cite a study done by the University of Washington, user groups there reported that before they had implemented this bill, only 50% of the time would they call in for someone who was having a drug overdose. And after the implementation, 88% said they would. And this may give some perspective on how many people this may have applied to.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just doing a little research on this. On the NCSL website, it mentions that Connecticut and other states limit immunity, and I know you're not doing immunity, but prosecution, but I'll just read it to you. It says, Connecticut and other states limit immunity by specifying that good faith reporting does not include seeking help during the course of the execution of an arrest or search warrant. Is that something that you have looked at all or have discussed? And I think basically the application would be, Mr. Chair, the police are banging on your door and they're ready to execute a search warrant, and you make a phone call to 911 and say, hey, someone's having a an overdose, and then you get immunity from. So I think that's what these states are trying to cover, but it looks like a number of states have done that. And I see Annie Carpinini in the back. Maybe she'd come up at some point and address whether that's an issue at all or not. But it doesn't sound like you've discussed that at all.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, we have not particularly addressed that in committee, in prior committees, although maybe I will defer to Annie Carpinini to answer that, too.
And it might go to what does good faith effort mean. So, you know. The other thing that I would probably ask is, you know, the term of art, good faith. So I'm taking it you've discussed that in committee previously. That's still probably a standard that that can be met. Have you come up with something? Do I need to talk to the Department of Law on how that might be argued?
Mr. Chair, I would, this is Morgan Hobson again for the record. In the way that we designed this bill, the good faith would imply that the person would have to stay with the individual who is overdosing until they made contact with the responding officer and comply with them by providing their name and information. And I do believe that if there were a circumstance where a responding officer was already about to enter a premise and someone attempted to use this, I don't believe that it would help them with anything other than any possession amount, if indeed there was a person who was experiencing a life-threatening drug overdose.
If that's something helpful. That we'll have to kind of keep in mind is that you're looking at one section. They're still, the way I understand it, if they are if they're possessing, using, displaying, there's still some responsibility on those, even if they do call. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, yes, you are correct. This would definitely would certainly apply to possession in the sense of personal use. If the responding officer who entered the premise discovered that there was an amount that suggested the person had intent to distribute, it would be a different scenario.
Yeah, and Senator Wilikowski, did you have questions?
On that point, has there been any discussion about whether or not this bill would act to suppress evidence and other criminal charges that arose from the emergency responders coming to the scene?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, that was why we changed the term from immunity to restriction from possession, because in Alaska we learned, and I hope that I am representing this accurately, that immunity may imply transactional immunity that could potentially affect the ability to prosecute those other charges, but with the new language that we added, it would not prevent pressing charges for any other circumstances.
Yeah. And you, yes, Senator Wilikowski.
And then just one last question, Mr. Chair, for now. I mentioned to Representative Pruitt, my staff had done some research and was wondering if you had looked into whether or not applying this to alcohol overconsumption.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe I did discuss this conversation with the Representative Pruitt, and right now I believe the intent was to keep the bill focused on this narrow scope with the hopes that we could pass it through this session. There are other scenarios that this could potentially address that may be of interest, although ideally, we would like to design this in a way that we could get this through this session, and hopefully it could save lives.
Yeah, and just for me, because we're restricting it under certain violations, I wouldn't want to give a false impression that that they are free of prosecution from misuse of illegal substances. Just a very narrow band of misuse here if they, in good faith, call for medical help and stay there on the scene, right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It applies very exclusively to possession for personal use.
One of the questions that I had, and I can go to Kathleen because I prepared a CS and I wanted to get Kathleen's take on this, is the applicability section, Kathleen. It says that this applies to offenses occurring before, on, or after the effective date. And I'm always reluctant to go before the effective date. So I was heading down the road of having a CS that would say on or after the effective date. And I understand that there was some discussion on that, this language still is only prospective.
This is Kathleen Strasburg, Legislative Legal Services. Mr. Chairman, it's essentially a policy choice. The idea is that it would apply to cases that would be in process. It could be worded so that there is a specific reference to cases that are in process at the time the bill becomes effective rather than simply saying before. There is a difference of opinion about whether the simple use of the word before creates significant problems or not. But it is ultimately a policy choice by the legislature whether to apply it only to people who commit their offenses after the law goes into effect, or those that commit it have already committed it, but whose cases have not yet been decided.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure that they understood it was a policy choice that we're going to make.
I could have worded a little more artfully, perhaps.
Well, welcome to my side of the bench. Every once in a while, we do things inartfully. Mm-hmm. So, any other questions on this particular issue? I see in this section, drug overdose means. Is that unique to this particular section of the code?
Mr. Chair, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question.
Okay, and on page 2, line 10, I think this is a new code because you're putting in a new section. So you're just tailoring it to this issue. So, all right. What I'll do is I think I'll get Annie Carpinetti to come up here and speak to a couple of the what I'm looking for in terms of art. What do they mean, and how big a deal is it? So, Annie, if you didn't mind, come on up here. We'll get the Department of Law to walk us through a couple of these questions. Thank you very much, Morgan.
Hi, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. We would really strongly recommend that you take the before off and adopt the on or after.
Yeah, because it would be my intention. I wanted to make sure it was pretty much prospective, and so you're going to see me offering a CS when it comes time. But I wanted to go through some of the other language. Good faith is a standard that is readily known and available.
Mr. Chairman, good faith is something that we use often in criminal law. It's the way this bill is constructed now, it would be the burden on the prosecution to disprove good faith by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That policy choice was discussed on the other side. We had suggested that this be made an affirmative defense, and that decision was made on the other side not to do that, which means that we would have that burden of disproving good faith. So I'm assuming that the scenario that Senator Wilikowski discussed about calling 911 just as the law enforcement was knocking on the door to conduct a search, we would I assume we would be in a position to have to disprove that call was in good faith.
And if it was affirmative, how would it look?
If it were an affirmative defense, the burden of proving good faith would be, and all the other parts of the provision on by proof by preponderance of evidence, which is 51% or 50 point something.
And I take it the policy call for making it something that had to be proven, that they wanted as much of an open door as possible for an individual to say, look, I was trying?
Mm-hmm. I think the rationale for leaving it in this form was that I would rather save lives and argue the legal niceties later.
And this is narrowly crafted to possession only?
Yes, it doesn't say personal possession. It does. These are possession offenses. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say personal possession.
So quantity is not the question. It's if they actually have it
in their possession, right. I mean, if there's enough of the substance to indicate intent to distribute, that would be another question.
Senator Volkowski.
If you get a call and there's police respond or firefighters respond, there's one person who's overdosed and there's, let's say, four other people standing around that person and there's drugs scattered everywhere, but within the limits,
mm-hmm.
Only the person who called gets the relief from prosecution?
That's what it says. That's my understanding. Although law enforcement tells us that they very rarely arrest anybody when they're called for an overdose. They are focused on saving that person. I'm sure it depends on the circumstances. If there's scales and baggies laying around, that might be a different story. But mainly when they're not concerned about investigating a crime, they're concerned with helping that person.
Senator Wilcox.
I asked this question before, but I was wondering the magnitude of the problem, if you know how many people this would have spared in, say, the last 5 years or 3 years.
Mr. Chairman, I don't.
We do have Randy Hahn with Alaska State Troopers online. Maybe we could at least ask him that question. Mr. Hahn, can you hear us?
Yes, sir.
Did you hear the question from the senator?
Yes, sir. I did hear that question, and through the chair, I don't have that answer at my fingertips either. I would have to do some research to see if we could even find that specific data in our system.
But what the Department of Law is telling us is that if you get into a circumstance where it's a life-saving circumstance, that you would probably go to that rather than just starting to charge everybody?
So that's absolutely correct. Our first priority would be the priority of life, saving the victim. If it looked like there was additional drug activity, if it looked like it was a potential distribution center, all of those sorts of things, all of that would follow in follow-up investigation down the road. It would be highly unlikely to have any arrest at that particular time.
Okay. Well, we didn't get the answer to Senator Bulikowski's question, but you have another one.
Just on the issue of the search warrants, do you? It looked like through NCSL they were saying that some other states have provisions excluding.
Does that go to the Department of Law or?
Yeah, for Department of Law.
Okay, that's for the Department of Law. Thanks, Randy.
Excluding this from search where there's a search warrant being exercised or there's an arrest taking place. Do you see that as an issue or something that we should be concerned about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski. That may occur. I mean, I guess it would be something that we could look at down the road if we find that we are unable to disprove good faith. Maybe we would want to consider that. But right now, I guess I don't. But maybe I'm being too naive about that.
You're retiring. You won't have to deal with it.
No, I wouldn't deal with it.
And we're very sad to see you.
Well, we've given a couple of requirements for cooperating, for certainly identification.
And staying, it's important that you require them to stay with the person, I think, too.
Right. And if that happens and it's been reasonably cooperative, then I would expect good faith would be easily defined. And that would be on their defense. I mean, you would have to prove that they didn't. That's what I understand, right?
Yes. This is kind of like a defense, the way it's structured now. And for defenses, we have to disprove that defense by proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Rather than saying it is an affirmative defense, we say shall not be prosecuted.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
From the policy perspective, is it your opinion that I think this is a good policy to put in place. I'm just wondering about whether you want to make it an affirmative defense or whether you want to do it this way. And does the department have a strong feeling on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, on the House side, we did suggest that, that it be structured as an affirmative defense. But the sponsor was not in favor of that, and it was not adopted.
Yeah, and sometimes we really like the prosecutors, and sometimes we really don't. And so I think in this particular case, the policy call is whether you want to say if you cooperated, you get the first benefit of the doubt, and they have to prove that you didn't cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
And all right, okay, I got that policy call. It's mm-hmm. getting settled in. Other questions? It was my intention to put a CS that took the date prospectively. And was there a question from the sponsor on that particular issue, on saying on or after the effective date? Is there any?
Mr. Chair, just so I understand, there's two versions before us. There's a P and an O, and
P is the
we're working off the P version right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've got a Z.
And it looks like don't.
I've got the O version.
P's the one that changes it.
Yeah, P is the.
Okay, was that your CS that you were going to introduce?
Yes.
Was P, and that removes the before.
Yes.
Okay. That's the only change.
Yeah. That's. And so I think policy call-wise, that's been something I've tried to catch most of the time in committee, and with rare exception, are we allowing ourselves to go back? I think one time we allowed something in motion, and it was, I think, debated pretty well. Anyway, for me, as just one of the things I prefer is to say the laws impacted prospectively. Senator Wilkowski.
Can I ask a law question on that? Sure. Would we be impacting if we pass this? There's potentially will be people sitting in jail or on probation or parole who were convicted under circumstances that they would now be innocent. Does that create a any sort of constitutional issues?
Through the chair, well, it creates serious practical problems, is because the bill, when it says before, it doesn't say how far back.
If we take out before though, and we just say honor. After, and then someone is convicted the day before this bill goes into effect, they're potentially in jail for 90 days or something. Is that impacted by the passage of this law if we take out the word before? In other words, we have people sitting in jail for a crime that is no longer on the books.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, that's, you know, we draw lines all the time when we adopt criminal laws, and our position always is that it's really important for you to tell us when we start applying a new law. That's why we would like to have it apply on or after the effective date. And there's no reason why this couldn't be an immediate effective date if you wanted it to come into effect sooner rather than later. Right now, there is no effective date on the bill.
I just don't like the idea of having people being punished for something which is no longer a crime, mm-hmm. which is what we do when we don't have the word before.
Through the chair, well, I imagine that our judges and our prosecutors and defense lawyers will take that into account when arguing sentencing the day before or soon before this bill goes into effect. Mm. And I believe that judges would take that into account when sentencing somebody.
It sounds like, at this point, the police have already taken some of that into effect when they're entering a scene, but the point's well taken.
And actually, a lot of the cases that we think this would apply to, or that might apply, a lot of the convictions for possession of drugs have been reduced, and are the subject of a plea negotiation too.
I'm probably more concerned about someone who maybe this was their second or third offense, and that caused something to be bumped up, and they've got a longer track record now. And I understand your position is, you know, you just want a cutoff date, so you don't have to deal with it. But at the same time, you potentially have people who are on parole, probation, sitting in jail for a crime which is no longer a crime.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, yes, that's, you know, there are different sides of that argument, but I think there's enough discretion in our system with judges and with prosecutors and defense attorneys to address unfairness under those circumstances. Because presumptive sentencing is where it would have an effect.
Well, and if I could go on,
Senator Wilczynski,
if you had someone who was convicted a year ago for this, and then they, maybe that was their third conviction or second conviction or something, it's no longer a crime, but when the judges look at it prospectively into the future, are they going to hold that against that person? How is that going to play out?
Well, through the chair, you mean, for example, if there's somebody is being charged with his or her third crime and it's a presumptive sentence that is higher because it's their third felony.
Exactly.
I assume that the judge would take into account the circumstances of the prior offenses and whether or not, you know, what the law is at the time when ascribing whatever importance there is to that.
Would they have enough discretion to be able to do that under our current sentencing laws?
Well, we have sentencing ranges, yes. Within the range, yes. And then somebody could claim that that there are unduly harsh consequences as a result of using that as part of request to go to a three-judge panel on that, too.
Mr. Chair, it's pretty rare that we take crimes off the books, so that's...
Well, this really doesn't take it off the books. It just says, I mean, it's still a crime to possess these substances.
Right, except there could be people who have been punished for this in the past who would not be punished for it now. Mm-hmm. So. But
through the chair, the problem is establishing those facts is really hard in the future because, you know, somebody would say, oh, yes, I was convicted of possession and I called 911 and nobody would know whether they stayed with the person and acted in good faith and various things like that. So those things make it really difficult to apply retrospectively.
That's fair.
So with that, I'll take a motion to adopt the P version.
Mr. Chairman,
a working document.
I move that we adopt Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 369 /P as our working document.
Any objection to having that? So the Senate got to mess with somebody's bill and actually put an amendment on it. And the way I understand it, we're talking about third, fourth, fifth degree misconduct. And we've pretty well defined the rules for good faith efforts, and the overdose is a new section. Would you come on forward? I'm sorry, I let you escape before. I had one last. And if you guys are okay with this, I'll bring it up to a vote if I get this.
Yeah.
Is this a new definition, or is this a definition that is something that we've worked on before?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's a new definition, but I think Mr. Oswald probably is in a better position to answer that question.
Mr. Who?
Mr. Oswald. It's not in Title 11. I will say that. It's not a definition that's part of Title 11 now. So.
This is Kathleen Strassel, Legislative Legal Services. The term is only used one other place in statute, which is actually a mitigating factor for felony sentencing. But it seemed prudent, given the fact that we're exempting people from prosecution, to give a definition. I'm not sure whether I got it from another state's law. I did examine several other states' laws, but I don't recall if I took it from one of those, or I think I may have done so, but I'm having a little trouble remembering which one right now.
Okay, thank you. The reason I was asking, Kathleen, and you may be the one that helped us think this through a little bit, does life-threatening emergency become a thing that is harder to prove under this drug overdose, or is that even going to be part of the discussion?
Well, I guess the not being an EMT, and well, you know, having that direct personal experience, I'm not sure whether it is possible to determine when you arrive on the scene how far advanced someone's problem is. However, after reading accounts of this, I was living in a college town a few years ago. It strikes me that there are that the people who arrive on the scene have make that may or may not make that assumption depending on whether people are having trouble breathing and so on. And so it seems like we would be relying there on whether the responders felt there was a danger when they arrived, but that would be a source of proof one way or the other.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I think it kind of hinges pretty solidly on the person reasonably believed, and I think that's probably where it would weigh on. But I just wanted to make sure that we're not asking for something that we can't get here. That's all.
Yeah, I guess unconsciousness and breathing difficulties, I think, are a couple of hallmarks that an EMT would be able to detect, or that would alarm an individual enough to call the EMTs, and that the EMTs could realistically indicate if called upon to do so.
I'm getting older, and people keep talking to me about signs of heart attack and all that stuff, and so I'm beginning to watch that more closely. Okay. I just wanted to ask. Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Just a question for law on the practicality of how this would work, because everything in here has to be proven by the prosecutors, right? So
disproven, actually.
Disproven. Okay. So police officers walking down the street, they see someone they believe has drugs. The person gets arrested, taken in. He's prosecuted under AS 1171-030A3. And then he says, I was having a drug overdose. And so disprove it. I mean, do you see people just raising this as a defense and saying, go ahead, go disprove it by beyond a reasonable doubt? I mean, do you see that as a problem?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, in order to raise a defense, the defendant has to introduce some evidence supporting it, and then the burden is on the prosecution to disprove that.
What's the amount of evidence that has to be introduced to show it?
That's what the courts say, some evidence.
Okay.
Some, and I, reliable evidence.
So, person's lying on the ground at a bus station, police officers arrest him, and he says, I felt like I was having a drug overdose, and that's why I lied down, and you found these drugs on my possession. I'm just wondering how serious of an issue does this raise for you and the prosecution?
Well, I would just say you have to seek in good faith medical.
Or Section 2. If that person was experienced a drug overdose and sought medical assistance. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, I think that would mean more than just laying down on the ground and reacting to a police officer who says, you know, what's up, and then responding. I mean, I think, you know, we always prefer to have an affirmative defense to a defense, but and as always, these would depend on the facts. You know, we prove people haven't acted in self-defense by proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
I'm just wondering if this is going to create an extremely high burden for prosecutors. It sounds to me like it's not going to be that big of an issue for you.
Well, through the chair, we'll find out. We're hoping it's not, you know, we reserve the right to come back to you if it is and ask for some sort of change.
With all of us retiring around here, who knows? But at least at this way, if they seek medical assistance under third to the fifth degree possession, that part would not be that part would not be applied to them. There might be other issues applied to them. But.
Through the chair, yes. I mean, this only says we can't prosecute you for these specified offenses.
You want to hold it over for Monday? Or?
I don't want to hold up the bill. I, you know, probably not a big deal. I think there'll be a case, there'll be some cases where this becomes an issue. The one concern I would have is on the search warrants, and someone knows they're about to be arrested and they quick dial 911 and report I'm having a drug overdose, and and that, and it looks like other states have dealt with that issue. If you don't feel like it's an issue to be concerned with, I don't want to hold the bill up, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think it, I mean, I think it could become an issue. I don't want to be dismissive of it. I think people will do that, or they will try to, you know, as soon as they know about this law, they will try and behave in a way that would possibly give them the advantage of this defense.
I think in both cases, it would have to be shown as a good faith effort. Do we need to say that explicitly in a sub 2?
Yeah, I think sub 2 is probably where the problem is, Mr. Chair. And I guess
let's just hold it over and let the sponsor think about it, and because we're down to the last bit. I wouldn't want to send it out here unless we thought we were making sure that, you know, if they have a responsibility, that they can exercise it.
Is there any another committee of referral?
I think we're it.
Okay. So it should still.
And he's got another bill up here Monday anyway, so.
Okay. It'll be here.
All right, let's just hold it over till Monday, and we'll talk about that, the good faith effort on sub 2, and see if it's implied or we need to make it explicit. All right, let's do that. With that, we'll bring 369 up at the beginning of Monday's. With that, we're adjourned.